Let's get going then. So I'm talking with Dan Cameron in his, presumably in his office at the Orange County Museum in Newport, correct?
That's right.
So now that the show, the 2013 California Pacific Triennial, has been up about 3 weeks now, is it?
No, we just actually had our second public weekend this week.
Oh, okay. So we're just a couple weeks in then.
That's right.
So are you sort of going to be in managing the show mode, or are you kind of leaning towards the next projects, or as a kind of combination?
Well, that's a good question. No, I think that maybe one of the things that people listening might not know so much about how museum exhibitions are organized on a scale like ours, which is at a medium scale that's requires a lot of people and a lot of time and preparation. The minute it's up and running, I've long moved on to the next thing, because there's nothing left really for me to do other than take people through the exhibition. I mean, that's the big part of my job now, is to do this kind of interpretation and educational programs that really involve sharing a lot of the information that I have from the process of working with the artists or developing the work, and then kind of putting that out to in a kind of a more public area and making a nice dialogue with people about that. But no, I'm working on the next exhibition and the next one and the one after that and the one after
that.
All of which seem late to me.
Sure. Yeah, you kind of anticipated what I was going to ask, if you're working on the next show and the next show after that, and obviously you are. Are there any that you can discuss at this juncture, or is that kind of under wraps until it gets much closer?
No, we've announced a few of those exhibitions, and the ones that I'm working on and I'm very interested in sharing right now. I mean, I'm interested in all of them, but the next one I think will be quite exciting, because it's my first opportunity as the chief curator to make an in-depth exploration of the museum's collection. And, we have thousands and thousands of artworks here in the Alcma collection, like any museum that's been around for as long as we have. And, there's a lot to sift through. There's a lot to choose from, but also to learn from. And I wanted to make an exhibition that reflected the fresh kind of research that was happening for me, not being a native of the West Coast and kind of coming here and being put in charge, so to speak, of this collection that really does reflect, that really goes in depth into art that was made here, mm-hmm. this community and this part of California in particular. And so I began thinking a lot about not specifically the LA history, but really the Orange County history of painting. And it seemed to me that the kind of self-evident trace of that was the sort of more plein air and modernist kind of competition that worked itself out here from the 30s, I would say, right up into the 50s. And, Laguna Beach and Newport Beach and, all these areas, Dana Point, each played its role in terms of how these positions were articulated. And, of course, as a result, we have a lot of the work that traces that. So I use that as a starting point, basically mm-hmm. saying, okay, who were the most outstanding of the, the sort of plein air group, and who are the most outstanding of the modernists, and what does their work look like when you put it together today, which is to me very interesting, sort of say, right. Do we even, are we invested anymore in these disputes? But then even more, where did that go? Where did that particular, I'm going to say, locking of horns or family rivalry, what did it evolve into? And so that made me start thinking about how it seems to me that in California, so much abstraction is based in landscape, is based in the direct experience of nature. So what I'm leading up to is the title of the exhibition, which is pretty straightforward, but
which is what again?
Landscape into abstraction.
Okay.
So it's just that simple idea of going from landscape into abstraction, and the transformation of that as it occurs in art here. mm-hmm. over the last, well, really over the last more than 100 years. So it's a lot of, I'm having a great time. I'm really enjoying putting that exhibition together and trying to articulate the various perspectives of artists who were working here, many of whom I'm just getting to know at this stage in real depth.
Mm-hmm. And this is particularly unusual for you because the vast majority of the shows you've been involved with have been very contemporary, correct?
That's right. This is maybe going back a little further than I'm accustomed to. I mean, I've done mm-hmm. on other occasions, but here, rather than saying let's throw this net out as far as we can and consider all the works out circulating in the world that would, you know, kind of go along with this thesis, that I'm not equipped to do. What I am equipped right. to do is literally, quite literally, and this is something you might be interested in, is going through the racks, you know, pulling mm-hmm. one rack after another, after another, after another, after another, and just looking at the works themselves.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll come across a work that, you know, when I originally saw it in a list of objects, it didn't really say much to me. And then I see the work itself and think, oh, my goodness, wow. All right. And start doing some research based on the artwork. And before you know it, in many cases, I've come across an artist who's of real interest to me.
Mm. Are the racks actually on site or in a separate storage area?
We have our art in three different places, including
okay.
here at the museum. So the museum is one site, but there are other sites off-site as well.
Right. Okay. Got it. So back to the triennial that's up now that yes. you are still talking about, if not working on.
Oh, yeah.
So the first thing that came to mind sort of concept or title-wise is Pacific Rim. And it's funny because this movie called Pacific Rim just came out, and I'm just wondering if that was a complete coincidence or had any impact whatsoever on the titling of the show, as opposed to calling it the 2013 California Pacific Triennial. What about the 2013 Pacific Rim Triennial, for example?
That was one of the topics. That was one of the titles we were banding around. But, you know, I guess that there was a sense that because – how do I want to say it? Because California had always been, you know, at the core of the identity of this exhibition, of this recurring exhibition, that somehow it was logical, let's say, to use the name, like California as part of the title, just to remind people, you know, where it originates and then where the exhibition is actually taking place. This is a California perspective, you know, point of view, to say it another way. But Pacific really seemed necessary. Rim became the word that, you know, you think, well, all right, that people say Pacific Rim, but this is something else. This is kind of like looking at the Pacific Rim from a California perspective. So when you're trying to come up with a catchy title, you don't add more words. You know, you really try to take away unnecessary words. But hey, if we were putting together a blockbuster movie, we might have come up with the title Pacific Rim. But it was a different.
Right.
It was just a we went one direction and the movie went in another.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, my first association with Pacific Rim is it was, I guess, a culinary trend maybe that started, I don't know, 15 years ago or something like that.
Yes, there was definitely that. And it went along with fusion, if I'm not mistaken.
Probably right. Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of the California perspective that you mentioned, so then was California an entry point to Chinese artists, to Vietnamese artists, such as I know that there's at least one, Vietnamese artist who was working here but is now back in Korea, in Vietnam?
Well, even more interestingly, I suppose, yes, Tiffany Chung was actually born at the very end of the Vietnam War in Vietnam, and her family left as refugees and came to California, and she grew up here. She grew up in Southern California and went to Long Beach for her undergraduate degree and Santa Barbara for her master's. And I think, you know, at that point was very aware, or was made aware, let's say, that there was a lot of kind of cultural transformation happening back in Vietnam. And I think there were some artists who were already fairly established who had made the decision to leave the U.S. and go to Vietnam. And that intrigued her, and she had family, and she decided, why not? You know, what was there to lose by becoming part of this change? And now she's really one of the most visible artists in Asia at all, you know, working not just in Vietnam, but really as an emerging artist, she's become quite prominent internationally. And I think that's really interesting. I mean, and you mentioned a Chinese artist. He's actually a Taiwanese artist who lives in Shanghai, but Michael Lin grew up in Santa Monica and went to Otis and art center in Pasadena, and he you know, was very much a California boy who, as a man, said, well, you know, I think I'm going to go to Europe for my career, and spent many years there, and at a certain point realized that he was much more interested in being part of what was happening in China today, and he's made Shanghai his base. But he's as California as anyone else who grew up here and, you know, skipped days of school and high school, you know, to go surfing in the summertime. But he just, you know, he happens to also be this international artist who is showing here for the first time. So what I like about the California point of view that I was mentioning before is how much this state, in particular the South, is a crossroads. You know, it's a place where artists who have already kind of gone on a nomadic exploration as part of their work, very often end up spending a very significant portion of their time. And I wanted to say, well, that's our identity. That's who we are.
Yeah. And I don't want to gloss over the potential, I don't know, trauma is maybe too strong a word, but the culture shock of, you know, each of these particular cases leaving California and living in the East. I mean, on one hand, it's a new adventure. You know, but on another, I mean, that's a pretty big life change, to say the least. And, you know, do you have a sense from both or either of them, you know, if there was a big acclimatization period and whatnot, and how long that took, and, you know, maybe how long it took before they sort of came to feel that they were part of their, you know, original cultures, as it were?
Well, you know, I haven't actually personally met Tiffany Chung. She'll be coming to the museum for a special public presentation in September. But I do know Michael a bit, and I think he is able to, many artists I've worked with are like this, he's able to maintain multiple identities and multiple the ideas of multiple homes or bases in his head. You know, his art consists almost exclusively of site-specific work, which means he has to be moving around constantly, going from place to place, administering and developing and completing the kind of the deal for these projects that he's making. And so that means there are many others who work in his place on various projects. So for me, that was really interesting, because when he was visiting us on a site visit, you know, many months before the actual triennial, but when he was getting a sense of where he might do his work, and he ended up making it in the entrance gallery of the museum, you know, we were spending the whole day just kind of talking, and I took him out to eat, and, you know, he was describing kind of being on the surf and growing up in Santa Monica. And suddenly he gets a phone call from a curator, actually a friend and colleague of ours, who's working on an exhibition in New Zealand. And suddenly Michael is off and running and speaking in Mandarin. And I realized that, you know, he is both this person that he just was to me a minute ago before he got the phone call, and he also is absolutely and totally comfortable in this other environment, which is, you know, being a contemporary Chinese artist. So I think it's not that people change from one to another, especially artists who find themselves working outside of where they live, in many cases thousands of miles away, just to maintain their career and their visibility. But these folks take on two and three different ideas of home and kind of function within them simultaneously.
Yeah, and before we get back to the triennial rather, it seems like a good segue to mention your sort of international space. And I think just to start with that you have been or were a New Yorker for, 30 plus years, and now you are in Southern California. And I guess the first question is, you can sort of take it whichever way you will, but were you one of those New Yorkers who never imagined that you would be based in Southern California?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate definition. I think my first professional trips visits to Southern California were about 25 years ago, and I would generally, especially in the early 90s, I would say I would try to be here at least once a year, and if I could, twice a year. And what I would essentially do is call people up and visit artists and go to galleries and maybe hang out with the collector and see what they were doing, and try to just absorb as much as I could. And but I never really did anything. I never pre presented an exhibition of my own in Los Angeles until a Paul McCarthy retrospective that I was curating at the New Museum in New York ended up opening first at MoCA, Los Angeles. So my curatorial debut in LA, in Southern California, was as the curator of a hometown hero show where, this was really McCarthy, who's now much more famous than he was back in 1999. A show that I had organized was really that kind of defining framing of his career at that point. So I felt, oh, that's nice that, I'm not in LA, but I'm not in Los Angeles, but I can feel like an insider. I can feel like one of the family. And over the years, I've worked with many, many, dozens of artists who are based here in Southern California, and I really have enjoyed the experience. But having said that, it just never dawned on me that one could live here, that you could just move and live here and work here. I just thought, wow, that only happens to certain very lucky people, or maybe people who grew up here. And then, of course, now that I'm here, I'm thinking, wow, it's not so impossible.
Yeah, now if you don't mind mentioning, because I this came up somewhere, that you're based in you live in Long Beach, is that correct?
I do.
Yeah, so you're basically, and I mentioned that because you're kind of halfway between the museum and Los Angeles. So presumably you can, go to work, but you can also be in LA to, see shows and whatnot. And so I imagine you're putting in a lot more miles since you've been here than you probably did in most of the time in New York on the road.
Well, I'm a to let's frame it a little more precisely. I became a car owner for the first time in my life when I moved here, and that was a year and a half ago. So it in that sense, yeah. I mean, in New York, basically getting on the subway and going from Manhattan to Brooklyn is as much of like going on the road as you're likely to take on if you're looking at art. I mean, for most New Yorkers, going to Philadelphia or going to New Haven or going to Baltimore, you wouldn't think of getting a car to do that. You just hop on the train, and go there. So yes, I mean, I put on more miles in a week than I would have in a year in New York. But you mentioned Orange County and the museum, and you mentioned LA, but you can't leave out Long Beach itself. I think one of the reasons I got interested in living there is because it's a city of a certain size, about 500,000, and it's got its own history and its own particular culture and its kind of weirdness and local specificity to it. Not particularly cosmopolitan, let's say, but it's got a very, very developed sense of itself. And it's part of LA County, of course. It's just sort of, part of this larger kind of mega entity geographically. So that in a way, when I go to work every day, it's like I cross back and forth between the LA and the Orange County lines. Whereas, if I'm going to LA, it almost seems like I'm going to another part of town. But Long Beach is actually quite interesting. It's for a place to live, I think it's got all this kind of particular range of cultural activities that I don't have to go to LA for. And I like that. I like that,
right.
You know, that, I mean, I'm, because of growing up maybe on the East Coast, I have this notion of roots and identity related to where I am. So I like identifying with the place I'm living in, you know, both in a regional sense, you know, being Southern California, but also that, you know, I didn't just choose Long Beach for convenience. I chose it because I was intrigued by its, by the particular identity it has. I thought, I think that might be a very interesting entry point into living in California.
I think the city of the Chamber of Commerce is very happy with you now. So I'm glad you clarified that you're not just picking a place geographically, but because of the place itself. So, but what I was also sort of getting to before is that based on a lot of the projects you were doing both in the 90s and earlier in the 2000s, it seems like you were doing a ton of traveling. And I guess sort of transitioning from talking about Michael Lynn, I wonder if there was a period of your working life where you sort of felt like you were living in many places, or was it more that you were just living in New York and doing a lot of travel?
That's a good question. I mean, I moved to New York to live in 1979. And since I kind of have a place there still, it's not necessarily that I've severed my ties with New York. Is sometimes it feels like I've expanded my own idea of what home is. But let's say in the 80s, in the kind of earlier years of the 90s, kind of when I was more of a developing curator, I spent an enormous amount of time in Spain. I made my first kind of high profile curated exhibition independently as an independent curator for a foundation in Barcelona and Madrid called La Caixa Foundation. And it just happened to be a particular exhibition that hit at the right time and was very good for me in terms of sort of launching my career and, you know, in a place where one project might have had a fortunate tendency of leading to another, but it also enabled me to adapt to another culture, not on a touristic basis, but on a professional basis. Suddenly, the people I was working with were my colleagues. I wasn't just hanging around or being decoration. And I began to have sustained artistic and personal friendships with a whole lot of people in Spain, and continue to. I get back as much as I can. So that's a classic case of identifying with the site one's working with. And I'd have to say the same held true even to a greater extent with New Orleans, because I had been a tourist in New Orleans since the late 80s when I first went for my first jazz fest, kind of staying. And when I launched the Prospect New Orleans project, I moved there and got a house and settled in and started being part of the kind of restoration rebuilding of New Orleans movement that was taking place in real earnest in kind of into 2006 and 2007, 2008, during the, you know, two or three years after Katrina, when rebuilding was really the primary thing, that responsibility that New Orleans had to itself, and people who love the city had to share that responsibility or not. So that was really, I mean, I thought, by the time I get finished with this project, New Orleans is going to be my home, you know, like my other home. And it did. It became that in a very meaningful way. So I think that's part and parcel of working in the field that we work in. I mean, I don't know if musicians would say the same thing, or, you know, actors or other creative people who find themselves having to travel a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you're a curator working at a certain level of international information, where all these artists are kind of their works are playing out on this kind of larger stage, then you have to be willing to just sort of jump on a plane and go somewhere, even if you have to turn around and come back right after you've done the thing that you
right.
see. Because, yeah, you have responsibilities in your office as well, at the organization you work with. But among the biggest responsibilities a curator has is to keep up with your field. You have to know what people are looking at, and you have to have seen it yourself to be able to make your own mind up about, you know, what you think. Is this great? Is it not? Is it, you know, is it a sleeper? Is it hyped? You know, there's a whole lot of quality judgments, value judgments that, you know, that people in our field have to be making on an ongoing basis. And the only way to make them accurately is to know what you're looking at.
Mm. Well, going back to the show you mentioned in Barcelona, that was 1986, Art and Its Double.
That's right.
Yeah. So how did that come about? I mean, I think the main question based on the premise of you know, place and where you're based and your relationship with Spain is, was that something that you kind of sought out, or is it kind of something more that landed in your lap?
A little bit both, but I did seek it out. I mean, my first trip to Europe, which I took as an adult, was to Spain. I mean, to me, for I have a particular aesthetic formation where I guess to me going to Europe meant going to the Prado Museum in Madrid.
Okay.
Which is essentially what I did with my first week in Europe in Spain, was mm-hmm. you know, look at Velázquez half the time.
Right.
I think what happened was early on, once I realized that one could do that sort of thing, like go to Europe and look at art, I also became, I mean, you know, Franco's dictatorship ended at the end of the 70s. And so one of, you know, if you were paying attention at all and you were in Spain in the early 80s, one of the things you were really conscious of was this kind of complete transformation of Spanish culture and society and politics, where things that had been forbidden for many, many years were suddenly not just happening, but they were kind of being flaunted in the street. And, you know, so I guess I got very inspired by seeing all that and experiencing it. And coincidentally, I was living in the East Village in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and a very similar kind of cultural renaissance was happening there. So what the Art and Its Double exhibition turned out to be, in essence, a museum scale survey of the very, very late breaking tendencies in the East Village scene, which by 1986 would have been the sort of neo geo or neo conceptual movement, or that's what they were called then. Or really artists like Jeff Koons, Chaim Steinbeck, Peter Halley, Barbara Kruger, Sherry Levine, Laurie Simmons, all of these artists were kind of part of a movement away from an expressionist paradigm of working to something that was a little more thought-based and using more appropriation of past art forms. And mm-hmm. I thought, well, I'd been asked to develop an exhibition about the East Village, and that got delayed. And then a new friend of mine, who's turned out to be one of my closest friends in the art profession, Maria de Corral, was at that time doing the exhibition program at La Caixa, and hearing that I was developing something, but that it got delayed, and I think she had her own doubts as to whether it would happen at all, kind of stepped in the breach and said, okay, well, what exhibition would you really like to do? And I said, well, what would be most interesting is to just show what's happening right now, not what happened with the graffiti artists in the early 80s, but here right in the mid 80s, and at this moment, this kind of transformation to more conceptually based approach. And she said, I think that would be fantastic. We're going to do it. Can it be ready by November of 86? And I just said, yes. And, you know, having this be my first big kind of gig or commission falling in my lap, I just threw myself into it, body and soul, and worked feverishly and tried mm-hmm. to get everything right. And as it turns out, this institution, the foundation, which is one of the most important cultural institutions in Spain, they did their part and really, really well. And it just was a very beautiful kind of coming together of all these different forces. And I, you know, the long and short of it is that, and I worked for the next 10 years in Europe. I never went without a serious museum project somewhere in Europe during the next decade, including co-curating part of the Venice Biennale in 1988. That came directly mm-hmm. out of the experience of working for La Caixa.
So that really put you on the map over there, and they wanted to work with you, it sounds like.
It did. But the salient point is, in terms of what we were talking about before, is this was an exhibition about my neighborhood back
right.
in New York.
Right.
It's happening in a in a country, in a place that had always been a dream of mine to visit. You know, it would have never been thinkable that's in, you know, growing up that one might actually work in Spain. You know, like the best one could hope for is, you know, going to the Prado and looking what was there.
But, right.
You know, the fact right. this was all happening to me and that it was coming out of my, let's say, inherent Hispanophiliac tendencies anyway, where I gravitate towards culture coming out of that part of the world. And, you know, it just all was quite, quite wonderful at the time because I was, you know, really young and starting out and trying to find ways to make this whole independent curator thing work.
Yeah. And I think it's important to maybe look into the fact that, or ask whether these artists that are now obvious, you know, neoconceptual / neo-geo names, at the time that you showed them, even in Spain, or especially in Spain, rather, were maybe not people names that people were familiar with.
No, they absolutely were not names people were familiar with. I think up until that point, Jeff Koons had been in one group show in Vienna, but this was the first. What we did in La Caixa was the very first large scale representation of Jeff Koons's work. And by the time it went from Barcelona to Madrid, opening it in Madrid in February of 87. And by that time, the whole Neo Geo thing had really caught hold as like a media story. And so the visibility of the exhibition was that much greater because his work kind of hit in a slightly scandalous way, like not scandalous exactly, but you know, there was a lot of people were quite shocked about the implications of Jeff Koons' work from the beginning. And so there was a little bit of a success to Scandal behind the whole thing. To me, I was very proud that, you know, I obviously didn't discover Jeff Koons or anything close to it, but, you know, I had seen his very early work and I was aware that some of my colleagues just thought, well, this guy has really got it all. And, you know, this is not a flash in the pan. And I just thought, well, you know, a friend of mine, a colleague who ran Jeff Koons' gallery at that time called International at the Monument, I just said, you know, look, why don't we just make this the real kind of first big scale kind of splashy debut of Jeff Koons in the public. And they went along with it and Jeff had a great time and it was really a wonderful experience.
Were any of the framed Nike posters involved in that show?
They absolutely were. Yeah, we had four Nike posters and we had entire Jim Beam choo-choo train as well.
Right. So I wanted to get back to the triennial. And the transition I want to use as we were talking about Koons and you know, these other names and, you know, who sort of exploded at the time, particularly Koons. But going through the list of the names of the triennial, I don't recognize a lot of them. And I'm being in LA and not recognizing a couple of the LA names. I like that a lot. I wonder whether this curatorial experience has been maybe a little bit different than a lot of the others that you've done in that there are a lot of names that maybe aren't well-known or stars, you know, that this is a biennial or triennial specifically where you don't have a lot of the brand names, as it were, that you typically find in international biennial type shows.
Well, you could, I mean, yes, that option is always open, I suppose. And by brand names, I think you mean, I'm guessing you mean more like kind of blue chip or kind of established.
Yes, I mean that, but more specifically artists who are typical picks for those types of international shows.
Well, it's a little hard with this particular biennial because it's been around for a while and there have been so many editions that, you know, it's somewhat incumbent on the curator of whatever edition it had been incumbent to not repeat names. So, you know, artists who were in earlier editions, and I know this hasn't been strictly followed, but as a general rule, it was always kind of accepted by the curators that of the various biennials that once they had worked with an artist, that the next curator had to find new artists to work with.
Right.
And that way the whole research process becomes refreshed, let's say, on a regular basis. Well, I kind of took that to heart too, and I ended up going to a lot of artist studios who either weren't represented by galleries, or they worked with some of the smaller galleries, or they had just had their first show, you know, where there wasn't yet an established kind of, you know, track record for them. And then in a couple of cases, I also invited artists who were kind of more mid-career, but who weren't necessarily, I felt, kind of established or getting exposure, or maybe it just appreciated in the way that I thought their work kind of merited. And so there was a desire to kind of do my own little bit of just, you know, seeing what these sorts of choices imply, you know, what kind of a statement that they make. I am an artist. I mean, as a curator, I feel like I'm always trying to decide whether I want to kind of reinforce established or more conventional viewpoints about what's quote unquote important, or whether I want to kind of try to figure out things for myself in my own way and try as much as possible to explore newer ideas in each project, like just kind of constantly refresh the page if you want. And, you know, I end up almost inevitably going in the latter direction. Seems to be, that's my nature. And I work better when I'm not trying to reinforce other people's points, but where I'm trying to kind of scare myself a little, set up a riskier proposition where, you know, if it works, great, but honestly, the potential for a disaster is always there. You know, if it doesn't work, it could be like really a fiasco. So you kind of have to, you know, when you're that involved in sort of the production of the exhibition and all the details and all the nuances and all the, you know, light levels and the sound levels and the colors and the, you know, the placements of things, you know, you really are pushing very hard on your audience as well. You're demanding that your audience pay attention to those nuances and details, whereas normally they might, you know, just think, you know, an exhibition is just a room full of pictures, and in this case it's anything but.
Did you feel, so you actually felt that with some of the artists that you were selecting, particularly with the multimedia installation, that there might be some things that could go wrong? Or is that kind of the way you're categorizing it?
Well, I was selecting things that I really liked and that I felt had a place in the exhibition, but which I also knew had a disruptive potential. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to say it, where if not properly framed or insulated or closed off or just monitored, it would, that some of these projects could actually negatively affect people's enjoyment of nearby things. And you really don't want an exhibition where, you know, one artist's work spoils another artist's work. It's just not.
I see.
It's not.
Which is something that certainly has happened in the Whitney Biennials, for example, past.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not.
Don't want to put you on the spot.
No, I kind of feel like everybody has their own. There's not a right or wrong way of doing things. You know, there's just the way that people develop their priorities. And for me, I like that there's a certain degree of overlap between artists, where you're always experiencing an artist's work in proximity to another artist's work. But then when you're dealing, as you said, with these different media, where digital art is up against painting, or where, you know, photography is up against fiber art, and all these kind of post-minimal and conceptual kind of tendencies are kind of swirling around each other in a very, very kind of mosaic-y way.
Right.
That's where you really want to make sure that the end result is harmonious and not just cacophonous.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm interested in this change that you've made as your first order of business as the chief curator, essentially, from the California Biennial to the California Pacific Triennial. Now, the obvious thing to note at first is that you have a history of doing international biennials, and so that this fits in well with that paradigm, with that model. But what, maybe the first question is, with all that said, what was the origin of the Pacific Rim, the Pacific area for you?
You mean in terms of the basis for...
In terms of the idea of the show.
Well, I guess I felt very intimidated by Pacific Standard Time and the very high bar that that had set for looking at the subject of California contemporary and late modern art. And I, you know, as a, you know, quote unquote, new arrival into town, it seemed that it would be, I felt presumptuous to suddenly add some kind of coda to that experience and say, you know, like a year after all those exhibitions closed, then say, you know, like, wait, you know, hold on. Here's another viewpoint about California art. I just thought that's not going to be a very meaningful contribution to the conversation that is going on here. But as I began to think about sort of what is particular about California, you know, how is California distinctive? I guess I began thinking in terms of, you know, geography and demographics, you know, that, you know, the location of California on the west coast of the, you know, United States is only one aspect of its positioning. And I think we're all becoming quite aware that the relative proximity, or at least orientation towards China, in California is playing and will continue to play a really important role in its economic prospects. And so I feel, you know, that if you then move from that to what are the demographics in California going to look like 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, you know, who are these people becoming? I realized, well, you know, it's all about the Pacific Rim. And not only that, but if you spend as much of your professional career in New York, like I have, I think that there's a tendency, and it's not universal, but it's there, to unthinkingly overestimate the position that you're making your pronouncements from. In other words, it's kind of New York and Eurocentric positioning of culture from that perspective gets sort of, you know, it can get over time, it can be very sort of tiresome, because it's not intellectually challenging to simply operate from this assumption that, you know, everything kind of begins and ends in New York, or at least that it's evaluated and measured, you know, in New York. And I thought, well, what if we simply, you know, dispensed with this kind of ghost looking over your shoulder in the discussion of California contemporary modern art, which is sort of New York, and just said, well, what? Let's just replace the Atlantic, which seems to be the, how do I want to say it, the sort of staging area for all this intercultural commerce and exchange, that on which this country was kind of developed, and replace it with the Pacific, and say, well, what's happening now, and the ideas and the people and the goods that are going back and forth across the Pacific maybe are as important today and increasingly in the future as that exchange was for the Atlantic, say 200 or 300 years ago. And then I thought, okay, well, that's an interesting premise to work from, that, you know, the Pacific is now the kind of the staging of tomorrow's culture, and California, unsurprisingly, is leading that transformation. So it seemed, you know, what I really needed to do, and I guess I was, again, fortunate that I had been able to work on many different projects in Asia and South America over the last, you know, 20 odd years. And I didn't have to start all my research from scratch. I actually had, you know, a Taipei biennial behind me, and I've worked on the Yokohama triennial, and, you know, done different exhibitions with a number of artists, you know, including up and down the Pacific coast of the Americas. And I thought, you know, I think that, you know, even though it's not a lot of time to put it together, I think we can make an exhibition that's credible in that it really does promote this idea that the Pacific, although it's the biggest entity on the planet, is also a point of communication and exchange between many, many different people of different cultures.
Yeah, the one thing that really stands out from what you said is kind of looking into the future, or sort of anticipating the future in the Chinese influence. So initially, when I think of China in the context of the Pacific area in relation to California, it seems so incredibly far away and distant, as it is for a lot of people in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
But when you put it in terms of the Chinese influence on the U.S. and California in specific and immigration and what have you, that seems a lot more like something that we can anticipate happening over the years gradually, maybe not overnight, but gradually and ultimately becoming important. So it's taking this larger sort of economic model, economic transfer and immigration and so on, and kind of having that as the sort of subtext or the overview for an artistic investigation.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what I was trying to do.
Good. I'm glad I got it right. I'm interested in as a curator working with these artists, some of whom, as you said, are even not exhibiting, not with a gallery currently. I know that you have these larger goals in mind, as you've talked about, with putting together a cohesive, an interesting group and sort of vision. But to what extent, either while you're putting, doing the studio visits and so on, and then ultimately deciding the show, and this goes along with any past shows you've done as well, are you cognizant of the impact that you're having on that artist in terms of their career? The explosion that we talked about with the Coons and the other East Village artists, was one thing. But still, even with the artists, particularly ones who are not previously known to a lot of viewers, coming into this show is going to have a huge impact on their career. So I'm just wondering your cognizance of that, either during your curating or after it's already done.
It really only comes up in certain specific instances, I think. I mean, when you really feel invested in an artist's work, whether they're younger or mid-career, yeah, you what you want at a certain stage of the whole operation is you want to convince other people to be as excited about this work as you are. That's kind of an ongoing project that I think a lot of curators would all acknowledge that they share. But so if the second or third or fourth time you work with an artist, suddenly something fantastic or a whole series of fantastic things happen for them, that's really, really good. What it also sometimes means, though, is that, you also have to weigh the sort of potential, the broad field of potential greatness out there when you're working as a curator. And I think the point I was making earlier, which was kind of about just amplifying or echoing, certain judgments of the marketplace or the kind of art world convention. And I really feel like, once that level of acceptance happens for an artist, and Coons is a perfect example, I've never really wavered in my support of Jeff Coons' work. I think he's a fantastic artist. It's the work has its ups and downs, as is the case with, many artists. But, when he's at his best, there's just no one who's more exciting and engaging and even enthralling sometimes than Coons. But he wouldn't fall into the realm of artists that I would work with today, because, my job is more to kind of get involved with the Jeff Koonses of tomorrow. Just try to say, all right, where is art going, and who are the artists that are kind of leading that change, that transformation, and what can I do as a curator to, make that artist's exploration one that reaches the greatest number of people.
Okay, speaking of Neo Geo, or which is obviously a troubled term for a movement, but it seems that there have been a number of, particularly around the 80s, I think, and it seems to have led up quite a bit since then, sort of a number of obvious art historical sort of movements that have been categorized. And currently, and in recent years, it doesn't really seem like there are many at all. And I just wonder if that's something you agree with, or if you see, say, within a lot of work in this show, a commonality that might in some circles being talked about as part of something, or maybe it's just a question of the art world and the art number of artists being so much larger now than it was, 25, 30 years ago.
Well, there's still a lot of conjecture about how this change has happened. My personal feeling is that there were all these schools and kind of warring factions in the 80s, 70s, and 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s, let's say, for right. a reason. And I think one of those had to do with the relatively small stage that the contemporary art occupied at that time, and this constant kind of competition between artists to establish their ideas. And so if you want to get people to, pay attention to your ideas, then you have to very often put them in opposition to something that's already existing. And so, you have these struggles, like, for many, many years, and people, I think art students in particular find this hilarious, that, for a very, very long time, abstract art and representational art did not get along, that they were not considered to be, it wasn't considered appropriate to show them together, that there was,
right.
there was a deep, deep, deep division between the people who, preferred one thing or another. And then if you were abstract, you were in a sense perhaps anti-representational. And that's all very dumbed down, but it's also I think indicative of some innate characteristics of how the art world was at a time when the art world was sort of a cottage industry. Yeah. And in my field, the paradigm that broke this kind of chain of thinking about things and the language that people used really was the beginning of a global art discussion, because that previous sort of abstract representational problem had so much to do with kind of a formalized notion of art. But, once conceptual art and increasingly identity-based art began to take hold of people's imagination, you suddenly had this possibility out there, which of all the art in the world, or all the art being made on the planet, being considered all at once as one sort of like pool of potential artists that one could choose from and work with. And that was pretty firmly established in 1989, with a famous exhibition called The Magicians of the Earth. And from that point, that was only a couple of years after my Art in Its Double project in Spain. I really think from that point, virtually every curator in the field stopped and dead in their tracks, took a look at what they were doing, and said, I don't want to be left behind. I don't mm-hmm. want to be part of the old order that when you say art or contemporary art, you're really only referring to what happens in three or four European cities and one or two, American cities and maybe mm-hmm. Tokyo. And that, was meant when people talked about contemporary art for a very, very large part of the 20th century.
Hmm. And I gather from what you're saying too, that may connect with your curating more of an international gathering for this show.
Well, it was a very idealized premise to begin with, this whole global art notion. But once you get comfortable with it as a, as an intellectual sort of conceit, I think the world makes a different kind of sense. It's the only way I can say it, that there's a different way of looking at the experience, let's say, of a Tiffany Chung, who really is not part of one culture or another, but part of multiple cultures. And this kind of blurred distinction of identities is, I think, a further evolution from the kind of 90s and early 2000s kind of trend towards more identity-based art. That was almost always working from an unspoken assumption that people had an identity to work mm-hmm. now. I think we're, you know, in the age of social media and kind of digital, the digitalization of our visual environment, this notion that, you know, we only have one identity seems terribly old-fashioned and kind of obsolete. And then, in fact, you know, we have the identities we construct. We have the identities that others, you know, construct for us. We have collective identities. You know, we have fictional identities. There's a whole lot of room for, you know, thinking of this in a more porous way. And I sort of typically, I think artists are right on the cutting edge of that change. And you do see a lot of that in the triennial.
Mm. I think I would be remiss if I didn't say that I think on a more provincial anecdotal level, the countering sensibilities that are continuing to go on tend to be ones around people who believe that painting is irrelevant and others that believe that it is still not irrelevant, that it's still relevant. I don't know if that's something that you hear around at all, but that's been my understanding and experience for a little while.
My feeling is that it's currently less of a problem than it used to be, but
okay.
That really, it would kind of shock me sometimes that, you know, someone who is interested in a particular conceptual approach to art would by necessity reject anything that involved, you know, sort of paint on a stick. And maybe that was, you know, or, you know, paint on a stick that's drying on a canvas. And maybe that's this kind of idea that, well, they felt rejected first, so then they were going to do the rejecting. You know, it's part of that old, you know, the old party line disputes of the art world of, you know, before the late 80s, where I think it was all really about a much smaller pie that people were trying to divide up. Today, and, you know, I think it, you know, bears mentioning that the contemporary art market is many, 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 many times larger than it was back then. So with this vast, immense pie sort of cut up, no one's bothering to get obsessed or too worked up about, you know, whether someone practices a different style than they do, right, or works in a different media. I mean, that could be, nothing could be less important.
Well said, Dan. Thank you so much for your time and for talking to me. I appreciate it.
No problem. I'm really glad to be part of this.